we're doing the central nervous system this week. The disease state that we're most concerned about when we get spinal fluid in the lab is meningitis. Meningitis, right. Okay, remember how many times I've said if you were going to walk the walk, you must talk the talk? Did you know there was a scripture that says that? Essentially. I therefore teach you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith ye are called. So, so he's saying all of these organisms and everything in your casual conversations just happen to bring them in. Let's review the anatomy just briefly. Most of you already know this. We went over this. We did this last semester. The central nervous system consists of two sets of nerves. One is the brain and the spinal cord. Well, that's the central nervous system. And then branching off of that, we have the peripheral nervous system. So we're going to be concentrating here on the brain and the spinal cord. There are three membranes that line the brain and the spinal cord. The outer layer is the dura mater, which is a tough fibrous connective tissue layer. Inside is the arachnoid layer, and then the innermost layer is the pia mater. So there's three layers there. In between the dura mater and the arachnoid layer is the subarachnoid space. Okay, so that surrounds the brain and down the spinal cord, and that's where the fluid is, the spinal fluid is. And that circulates nutrients around there, and it protects the brain. So it's a cushion. In this area, there are some cavities called the forget what they're called. We don't care about that. Choroid plexus. And that's where the spinal fluid is formed. It's actually a filtrate, ultrafiltrate of the blood. And then you've heard of the blood-brain barrier. Is that an actual barrier? Is that an actual lining?
No.
What is it?
It's a... Yeah.
It's what?
Blood cannot go past.
Why? What is it? It's just the tight connection of cells. The epithelial cells forms a very tight connection, and we call it the blood-brain barrier, so that many substances cannot pass from the blood into the spinal fluid.
So where
does
that happen?
What happens?
Where is the barrier?
It's between the blood and the spinal fluid. So somewhere up in here where the blood enters and is filtered in the choroid plexus.
So that big black area right there is where the blood's coming in?
Yes, that's where it's filtered. The blood is filtered, and we get the ultrafiltrate of the blood, which is the spinal fluid. It's just a tight, very tight barrier, I guess like human connecting cells, tight epithelial barrier that prevents substances from crossing. However, there are some microorganisms that can cross the barrier, and that's how we get meningitis. So sometimes when we have an inflammatory condition, that barrier is a little bit loose, and so substances can pass through there. Which is helpful in the sense that antibiotics can pass at that point too, which they can't always pass that barrier. Okay, let's talk about how we get organisms into the brain or the central nervous system that can cause disease. One is by trauma. So if we have a skull fracture, backbone fracture, spinal column fracture, something there that allows microorganisms to enter the spinal fluid. Medical procedures such as lumbar puncture, which is commonly known as a spinal tap, or shunts that are inserted. Some organisms travel along the peripheral nerves, which is one in particular. It's a virus. It's herpes, herpes simplex. And other types that are related in that family, but they live in the peripheral nerves and they can travel along the peripheral nerves and enter the central nervous system. Hematogenous would be maybe something like an abscess deep in the tissue somewhere else that leaves the abscess and gets into the blood and then circulates around to the brain. What's contiguous? What does that word mean? Contiguous spread?
Transverse spread.
Contiguous means closely anatomically related, very, very near. So upper respiratory tract infections, sinusitis in the sinuses, the inner ear, otitis media, middle ear, those are very close anatomically to the central nervous system, to those linings. And so we can have infections there that can spread into the brain. So that's what contiguous means. Okay, so the main diseases that we're talking about then, primarily meningitis. What's the difference between meningitis and encephalitis? Meningitis is an inflammation or infection of the meninges, which are those three layers that line the central nervous system. And meningitis, the inflammation or the infection occurs within the subarachnoid space. Encephalitis, on the other hand, is an infection of the brain parenchyma. What's parenchyma?
So, it's an embolism.
An embolism? No, not parenchyma. Parenchyma refers to the brain tissue. So it's the tissue somewhere. Let me go back to the picture here. So meningitis occurs here in the subarachnoid space. Inflammation of the meninges, those three layers. The brain parenchyma would be any of these, any tissue area in the brain. So that's primarily where encephalitis occurs. Okay. And encephalitis is usually caused by virus, whereas meningitis can be either bacterial or viral. Encephalitis is usually viral. Okay, let's go through specimen collection. The spinal tap or the lumbar puncture between the third and fourth lumbar vertebrae. So the patient usually kind of lies on their side, curls up a little bit to open up the spaces a little bit better. We cleanse this off with a iodine solution or something similar to that because we've got normal flora on there. And one of the problems with spinal tap is you can introduce normal flora into the spinal column. You don't want to do that in the spinal fluid. So you need to cleanse that off very scrupulously. Of course, we don't do that. Doc does that, and the nurses. But oftentimes we're there to collect the sample. So the doc then inserts the needle, and it can be painful. It punctures the membranes, it gets into the subarachnoid space, and the fluid is then withdrawn.
The patient or the lab person?
Okay. But should it be any more painful than an epidural, right?
Well, they usually do a local anesthetic before they introduce the needle, so it's not always as painful as that. It depends on how many nerves they get going in and things. Okay, so we need to collect 10 milliliters minimum, if possible. And those are put into aliquot into three tubes. So the first tube usually goes to chemistry. That's what we talked about last semester, only so you know about this. But we do protein and glucose are the most common chemistry tests we've done.
10 milliliters seems like a ton, and it doesn't affect your central nervous system at all.
Well, first, take the pressure. When they insert the needle, they've got a pressure gauge on the needle. They'll take the pressure of the spinal fluid. And if the pressure is elevated, then they cannot withdraw that much, and that will cause herniation of the membranes. But if it's normal pressure, they can withdraw 10. On adults, on children, it's different. The children don't have that much. But that's preferably what we would like. And then one of the common problems or complications for spinal fluid or spinal tap is headache. Many times the docs, after they do a spinal tap, will just have the patient remain in the office or wherever they do it in a recumbent position to kind of equalize the fluid, let the fluid rebuild a little bit. Because when you stand up, that puts more pressure. So headache is the most common one, but usually there aren't other complications if they withdraw when the pressure is normal. And if they scrupulously cleanse it so we don't introduce organisms and cause an infection that way. Okay, then usually, probably preferably, the second two would go to hematology. And they do a cell counter differential. You know all about that. Okay, then the third tube would go to microbiology because the third tube has the least number of microorganisms in it from the skin.
So Jan told us the other way around, that the second tube would go to micro and the third one would go to hematology because they need one without any blood in it and you just need one without any microbes.
Right, and that's dependent upon the lab procedure. Ideally, if micro was stating what they wanted.
They want the last. Want Everyone wants the last.
Yeah, right. But it is important that hematology not get, if it's a traumatic tap, that they not get blood in there. And if the area is cleansed scrupulously, then there shouldn't be many microorganisms in there. So either the second or the third, depending upon what the lab protocol is. So we do in microbiology, gram stain and culture. That's what we're going to talk about today. Okay, let's talk about specimen processing then. Spinal fluid is considered a staff procedure, which means when we get it, whoever is doing spinal fluids for that day or that week, usually they'll have one person that's responsible for it. As soon as they get to a stopping point with whatever they're doing, then they go ahead immediately and process the spinal fluid. Because if it is a patient in the ER waiting for results with possible meningitis, they need preliminary results as soon as possible. So, what we do, now spinal fluid normally is clear, it looks just like water. So if it's clear, we will not do a gram stain immediately, we just go ahead and centrifuge it. But if it's cloudy, then it's got something in there. Microorganisms, protein, something could be in there, blood. So we'll do a gram stain immediately on cloudy spinal fluid and send that report back to the ER or the doc or wherever it came from. Because sometimes we can see microorganisms in there, and if they happen to be gram-negative diplococci, what could that be?
Neisseria
meningitis. So that's presumptive identification. I mean, that's all we can say is presumptive identification. But that's important for the doctor to know if you see something in there. Okay, then we'll go ahead and centrifuge it. We centrifuge 10 minutes at 1500 RPMs, which is just the usual speed. We decant the supernate. What's the supernate? Top part, the fluid on the top. We decant that and save it because if we didn't have, if the doc was not able to draw 10 milliliters, then, and he still wanted chemistry studies, then they could send the whatever amount they got to micro. We can centrifuge it, we can send the supernate back to chemistry, and they can still do chemistry's protein glucose on the supernate. So we never discard it, save it. And then we should have a little bit of sediment in there, in the bottom of the tube. We don't want to just flip it to mix it, it has to be well mixed, so we usually will vortex it to get it well mixed, because we don't want any microorganisms trapped in little tiny chunks or something like that. So we need to get it vortexed. Then we take a sterile pipette, take one drop of the sediment, and put one drop on a blood auger, one drop on a chocolate auger. That's usually the only medium we need. Most everything we can isolate from spinal fluid as a causative agent, we can culture on either blood or chocolate.
Are you gram staining the actual sediment? Or
yes.
Okay, so you go through all these steps first, and then you gram stain.
Right. That's on the next slide. And then some labs will do an enrichment broth, tryptocase soy broth auger. It's kind of a semi-solid broth in a tube. Thioglycolate is another one that they can use. It just depends on the lab whether they're going to use the enrichment broth or not. Okay, if it's cloudy, they probably don't need to use an enrichment broth, but that depends on their protocol. Okay, then we just streak for isolation. Okay, other things we can do. If the doc suspects a parasite, amoeba, we can do a direct wet prep, but we won't do that unless the doc specifies it. They used to do India ink, and in some places it's still done, but there is a better test for India ink, or a better test for Cryptococcus. This test for, what is Cryptococcus neoformans? Anybody know what kind of organism it is? It's a yeast. Fungus, yeast. And the reason that's important is because in later years, with the immunocompromised population and the HIV positive and AIDS patients, we're seeing a lot more cases of cryptococcal meningitis. So we need to kind of be able to identify that one. The Indy ink test, what we do is just take a slide, put a drop of Indy ink on it, and then we put a drop of our sediment in there. Cryptococcus is a round yeast and it has a capsule. This is the capsule around it. This is a budding yeast. We're going to talk about mycology in the last part of the semester. That's all we look for. So it displaces the Indy ink. It does not pick up the stain. We look for that. But it's not that sensitive. If the organism is there, it can be missed easily. So what they do now preferentially, instead of Indy ink, is, let's go down here, to latex agglutination. So there is a latex agglutination test for Cryptococcus. There is a latex agglutination for other encapsulated organisms as well that might cause meningitis. So, and latex agglutination is just a slide test, pretty much, an antigen antibody test where you put the antibody on and look for the organism. So those types of tests are replacing these slower, more cumbersome, and less sensitive tests. Okay, then we do a gram stain on the sediment and report immediately. So either the cloudy, if we did it on the cloudy, uncentrifuged, we're still going to do it again on the sediment and report it. Now, sometimes we don't see any organisms on gram stain, and yet we look at our plates the next day, and it's there. You have encountered that? You haven't seen anything on the gram stain, but it's grown up on your plates? Well, one of the reasons is that the sensitivity of the gram stain is such that we have to have at least 10 to the 5th organisms per milliliter in order to see them on gram stain. So it's very possible that we have fewer than that. Therefore, we don't see them immediately on gram stain, but we will see them, we will see the growth the next day. And that can happen not just with spinal fluids, but with any gram stain. So that's one thing to consider if you're not seeing organisms immediately. Okay, there's another stain that's called Aquadine Orange. It's a fluorescent stain, but its sensitivity is much greater than the gram stain. You only need 10 to the 4th organisms in order to detect it, but you also need the fluorescent microscope in order to observe. So many routine laboratories maybe will not do that. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe Primary Children's Hospital that deals a lot with, of course, the infant population, they might have a setup where they're able to do a little bit more sensitive test. But at any rate, I just want you to know what Aquadine Orange is. It's a fluorescent test. The organisms just pop up under fluorescence so you can see them a lot better, and it's more sensitive. The problem with the Aquadine Orange, however, is it does not give you gram stain morphology. It does not tell you if it's gram positive or gram negative. But you can do gram stain on top of the Aquadine Orange. If you see organisms, you can do a gram stain reaction, and you can do a gram stain. Okay, we can do serological. Now, what does serological mean? Antigen antibody. Okay, antigen antibody studies. Okay, you remember the Quellen reaction? Most of you probably don't if you didn't remember it on the exam. The Quellen reaction is an older test, but it tests for capsular swelling. But it's not specific for any one organism. We can do Quellen for strep pneumo, Haemophilus influenzae, Neisseria meningitidis, all of these have capsules, so it's not specific for that, but it is an older one. More specific would be latex agglutination, where you can get specific tests of antibodies for certain organisms. And that's really important when you're screening for meningitis in an infant or a child. You have some quick results. Okay, in the event that we don't see anything on our stains or our media, usually we'll examine them daily for 5 days, examine the plates before discarding them and reporting it as no growth. But again, that depends on the laboratory protocol. Some labs might only hold it for 3 days or whatever.
I'm sorry, did you say that the Quellen was more sensitive than the latex?
No.
The latex is more sensitive.
Latex is more sensitive and more specific.
There you go.
Yes. I hope I didn't say that. Okay. Yeah, latex is more sensitive and more specific. Because you can get antibodies for specific organisms with the latex. You can't do that with the Quellen. Okay, let's talk about our new organism that we're introducing this week. I want you to meet Listeria monocytogenes. It's a gram-positive rod. It can have, well, the coccobacillary means that it is a rod, but it can be short, fat. Sometimes it even looks like cocci. Which, if it looks like that, oh, I think I have a stain right there. There's a gram stain. So sometimes they look gram-positive cocci. They could be confused with a strep. They are beta hemolytic. It's kind of a more of a soft hemolysis. It's not a real distinct hemolysis. But other times they can look very distinct rods. So we'll see, because this is one of our organisms this week. Okay, beta hemolysis, but it is catalase positive, which will help differentiate it from what? Staph or strep? Strep. Strep, yeah. Strep is catalase negative. Okay, it is bioisosteric positive, and it is modal. Now, we're going to do a fun thing with Listeria. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's still fun to do it. We're going to inoculate two motilities. We're going to incubate one of them at 25 and one at 37. This is just the regular motility, not the one with the red indicator. The flagellates tend to be more mobile, or the organism is more mobile at 25, and so one of the characteristic features of Listeria, classic characteristic features, which means we may or may not see it, is umbrella-like motility. See that motility pattern? And that's what's fun about this, if you can see it, but sometimes it doesn't always do that. Usually you can tell if it's mobile anyway, so we're just going to stab this halfway down. Remember to be careful, no jerks. And we'll leave one at 25, and we'll incubate one at 37. See what happens. Look for that umbrella motility. Okay, as far as disease states, why we're concerned about Listeria is that it can cause neonatal sepsis. So the neonates, the infants, are most susceptible to infections by Listeria. It can cause neonatal sepsis. It can cause meningitis, either neonatal or immunocompromised. And particularly in pregnancy, in adults, it causes a flu-like illness. So it's not devastating in an adult. It's kind of a flu-like illness. But during pregnancy, it can cause the placenta and infect the fetus. So that's the problem with Listeria. How do we get Listeria? Foods. Immunocompromised, but you encounter it usually in foods. Hot dogs. Hot dogs. What do you mean?
So stomachs? Or like cold?
Isn't it also a problem in like milk products?
Yeah, like
and cheese, yeah. Could be encountered those. Yeah, it's more of a gastrointestinal problem with flu-like illness.
I was thinking flu-like, like, you know, fever chills, cough, but it's like
more of a stomach flu-like illness, right? And there have been product recalls. I remember not too long ago when there was a recall of hot dogs. I love hot dogs. That's what I remember. contaminated with Listeria. Okay, here we go. Here's a chart that shows these are the most common pathogens that we encounter in the spinal fluid as causative agents of meningitis. And they're listed in order of occurrence. So Haemophilus influenzae, this is type B, because there are other types, other serotypes of Haemophilus influenza. This is the one that we get vaccinated for, the HIV vaccine. Children get vaccinated for, at 2 months of age, the HIV vaccine for that particular serotype, because that's the most common one. But there are other serotypes that can cause problems. So this used to be the number one cause, but it's not anymore because of the vaccinations. So if the infant has been vaccinated, then that kind of drops out of the picture. But it causes influenza, usually from age, from newborn to up to 6 years. These are just summarizing the characteristic features of Haemophilus, the growth patterns. So when you look at that, you should review that, I would suggest. Next one is Neisseria meningitidis. So you need to know the age groups in which these occur. You need to know. Because meningitis is one of the diseases that the doc will prescribe empiric therapy. Do you remember what empiric therapy is?
Like presumptive.
Right. Because it's presumptive therapy. We don't know what the organism is yet. But if the child, the infant, comes in with symptoms of meningitis, the doc is not going to wait a few days for the lab to come up with a lab report. They're going to start treating. So they'll treat it based on the most probable organism for the age group. So, Haemophilus influenzae, newborn to 6 years. Neisseria meningitidis has two age distributions. One is 6 months to 12 months, and the other is 15 to 29 years, adolescent and adult. And that one occurs, Neisseria meningitis in that age range occurs mostly in young adults your age living in close quarters, like dormitories, military barracks, those kinds of things. Okay, strep pneumo, mostly adults. And this doesn't mean that you can't encounter it in other age groups, but this is just the most probable. Strepaglachia, less than 3 months, so Staph aureus can cause it. Here's listeria, less than 3 months. E. coli even can cause it, less than 3 months. And then we've got these rare ones. We've talked about Mycobacterium tuberculosis, how it can spread to the brain and cause tuberculosis meningitis.
So if you have a really young baby, which one of those three would you treat for?
If the mom was group B strep positive.
Yeah, you remember this one, Strepaglachia, is where we screened mom prior to birth to see if she was colonizing, and pass it on that way, so that would be one indication. We're going to talk about treatment on Wednesday, so we'll go through this list again. Okay, so again, this part is just review, so make sure you review. Okay.
We need no whiners. No whiners.
Is that a dog?
Not a cat.
I think that's compliments. Yeah. I just love it when people send me like it. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about ear and eye infections. We've already talked about ear infections, really, so we don't have to talk about that anymore. Do you remember otitis media? What are the two most common causative agents of otitis media? Sarah? You've got it. Strep pneumo?
Staph?
Haemophilus influenzae? Okay. So, again, I mentioned this just because of the closeness, the contiguous spread of organisms that colonize the nasopharynx, back of the throat, that can move along this very, very tiny, short eustachian tube, cause ear infections. They can also get into the meninges and cause meningitis or infections that way.
Okay. How does it get to the meninges from there?
Excuse me?
How does it get to the meninges from there?
The meninges are very close to this area. And so it can spread. It spreads somehow, and I don't. Well, in fact, we'll talk about that a little bit more on Wednesday. We'll illustrate that a little bit better. Okay, let's do eye infections. The anatomy of the eye. The two things that we're concerned with the eye, the conjunctiva. Conjunctiva is the lining of the eye back here, mucous membrane that lines the eye, and it lines the eyelids. So it's the inner part of the eyelid, it's the conjunctiva. And then we've got the cornea, which is this outer part of the eye. So we can have infections of either the conjunctiva or the cornea. And these are given different names, conjunctivitis, inflammation of the cornea, the conjunctiva, trachoma, pink eye, which is a type of conjunctivitis, keratitis, corneal ulcer, keratoconjunctivitis. So there's a lot of different infections, but it's mostly occurring either in the conjunctiva or the cornea. Okay, as far as specimens, we can use, and specimens are usually collected by an ophthalmologist. They're not something that we do in the laboratory. There's a special spatula. It's called a Chimera spatula. It looks like this. and the doc will take scrapings of the conjunctiva or the cornea. And sometimes they can put a local anesthetic in there too so that it won't hurt as much. But they just gently scrape the conjunctiva, the cornea, and put those scrapings, they can inoculate the media right there. If they have, if they're an ophthalmologist and they do a lot of this, they probably might have media that they can inoculate immediately. Or collect it in a sterile container. We can use swabs. These are pre-moistened sterile swabs. They can be rolled over the conjunctiva. So you can pull the eyelid back a little bit and roll it over that way. So those are acceptable. Is the eye sterile?
No.
No, it's not. There are some normal flora, and particularly on the skin, just right up or surrounding the eye. It's pretty hard to get to touch the eye and not get some of the skin. So you can still get staph, epidermidis, diphtheroids, other types of organisms that can be normal flora in there, so we have to be aware of that. Sometimes a needle aspirate is indicated, particularly if an anaerobic infection is suspected, and this would be mostly in the sinuses, but you can't reach really any other way besides a needle aspirate. So a needle will be inserted, and sinus fluid will be extracted. And then the media is usually just, again, blood and chocolate. So most of the organisms that we're going to encounter in eye infections can be cultivated either on blood and chocolate or both.
I'm sorry, which sinuses?
The sinuses back here.
Okay, so not strictly between the eye, but like... Okay.
Yeah, sinus that could lead to eye infections, but I don't think they'll puncture the eye with the needle. Okay, so some of the organisms then that we might encounter as pathogens. Staph aureus, Haemophilus aegyptius. Okay, this is very similar to Haemophilus influenzae, except it's a little more fastidious, which means we need a special chocolate. We need a little bit more enriched chocolate media to grow it on. But it is X and B factor, requires both X and B factor like Haemophilus influenzae. In fact, Haemophilus influenzae can be a cause of agent too, because we find that a lot in sinus infections and ear infections and so all that surrounding area. Okay, strep pneumoniae, Neisseria gonorrhea, various types of strep. Now, what are these three organisms? Marxella, Acinetobacter, and Pseudomonas. What group do they belong to?
Those are all non-fermenters.
Fermenters, right. Okay, you guys, don't forget this stuff. What's that scripture in Deuteronomy? Remember and forget not. Okay, Chlamydia trachomatis. There are different types of chlamydia. There are different strains of Chlamydia trachomatis. This particular one causes trachoma, which is the leading cause of blindness in the world. Not U.S., but in the world, the leading cause of blindness. Okay, let's talk about conjunctivitis. Okay. It results in acute or chronic inflammation of the conjunctiva. Again, the mucous membranes that line the eye and the inner eyelid. And we can get infections by airborne fomites. That's things floating around that happen to float into your eye. Hand-eye contact. So not a good idea to rub your eyes unless you've washed your hands. Symptoms would be reddening of the surface. We'll take a look at a slide here. Tearing. What's hyperemia? Increased blood or dilated vessels in the eye, and then there may or may not be a purulent discharge. What's purulent?
Let's see.
Okay. So, causative agents of conjunctivitis, Haemophilus influenzae, aegyptius, which again is fastidious, requires both X and V, like Haemophilus. Conjunctivitis is often referred to as pink eye. You've probably heard of pink eye. Some of you may have had pink eye as a child. Okay. Aureus, Staph aureus, Trachomoniae, Neisseria gonorrhea. It causes a very severe infection in infants known as ophthalmia neonatorum. Okay, let's take a look at some slides. Conjunctivitis. So you pull that eyelid down and you can see the mucous membrane is very red. And that's more hyperemia, where you see the increased blood supply or the dilation of the capillaries in there. It causes redness and the sclera.
Dumb question. But I was told a while ago that, like, primarily the only way that you get pink eye is if you have feces in your eye.
Not true.
Right.
Not true. You get feces in your eye, and you've got a ton of organisms in there that can cause disease. Because the coliforms, the Enterobacteriaceae, can cause disease too. But like I said, they are both fomites and isontem. Different ways to get it. Okay, here's pinkeye. So you can see the pinkfish there. This is more. Look at the. What do you call this? Swelling. Edema, inflammation of the eyelid, edema, swelling there.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I should have it that.
Who would let their eye get that bad?
Well, remember, some people don't have access to medical care immediately. And sometimes it can develop very quickly as well. Okay, this one is called acute gonococcal conjunctivitis or ophthalmia neonatorum. It is frequently caused by Neisseria gonorrhea, but it can be caused by other organisms, okay? That is not the only organism. This occurs in neonates three different ways they can get the infection. One is an ascending infection from the vagina and cervix. That means mom's got an STD, sexually transmitted disease. She's got gonorrhea. The organism is there. If there's premature rupture of membranes prior to birth, the organism can be released across the placenta and the infant can get infected that way. Or at the time of birth, the infant can get the genital urinary secretions in their eye at birth with the organism in there. Or contamination during the neonatal period, after birth. So it can occur before, during, or after birth. One way that they prevent this is to put erythromycin drops, they used to use silver nitrate drops, but now they've gone more to erythromycin drops, in the infant's eye. I've got a slide. Where's my slide? That must be on, must be coming up. Put drops in there, in the eye, at the time of birth, and that helps prevent the disease.
And if they also just did C-sections, if you had anything, just...
That's one way to get around it, too, is to do the C-section. It does not prevent contamination during the neonatal period, however. If the mom is infected, it's still possible for mom to transfer the infection to the infant. Okay, here's acute gonococcal conjunctivitis. This is a little bit older. It's not a neonate. It doesn't look like a neonate to me. But you can see how prevalent the discharge is. Here's the neonatal. The inflammation, the redness, the swelling. Closed and shut. And that can lead to blindness. That's the problem. It can lead to blindness. So there's the erythromycin drops. And oftentimes they'll do that just as a precaution to any infant, whether or not the mom is colonized. Okay, let's see. Oh, let's talk a little bit about keratitis. Keratitis is a corneal infection or injury. More severe than conjunctivitis. Usually there's acute pain, a lot of pain associated with corneal injury. And it can result in ulceration of the corneal epithelium, which can lead to blindness. We need corneal scrapings. We need to culture those. Here's neonatal. This is a combination of conjunctivitis and keratitis. So we call it keratoconjunctivitis.
So do they just swab the blood and put it on the plates then?
They will use a swab, pre-moistened sterile swab,
okay.
Or preferably the scrapings.
Okay.
And then they just put that on blood and chocolate.
Which one's more preferable, the swab or the scrapings?
The scrapings would be preferable.
Okay.
But a swab is acceptable. Yeah.
Is this what you said? Which one did you say was the number one cause of blindness?
Chlamydia trachomatis. Trachoma, the disease, is blindness from chlamydia trachomatis. Okay, this is a corneal ulcer. One of the things that can result from corneal infection is an ulcer. And again, that can lead to blindness. Pseudomonas is another causative agent of keratitis that can lead to blindness. Sometimes within 24 hours, these things can happen very, very quickly. Okay, here's trachoma. It's caused by chlamydia trachomatis. Chlamydia also causes a sexually transmitted disease. And it is also chlamydia trachomatis, but it's probably a different serotype. We'll talk about that later. So, one of the leading causes of blindness worldwide We can do a different stain called Giemsa stain for chlamydia, because remember, chlamydia are intracellular parasites. They invade the cell. So we can't culture. We can't culture for chlamydia on routine laboratory media. What we need is a cell culture. And typically what they do is have little vials with these McCoy cells. They're mouse or rabbit fibroblasts or something. Some living cells in the bottom of the tube, the vial, and they put the scrapings in there and then culture that and look for these intracellular inclusions. So it's not something that we do in a routine hospital laboratory. That has to be sent out to a lab that specializes in doing cell cultures. Okay, there's trachoma. You can see the thickening here of the conjunctiva, and then it affects the cornea as well. So that can be a very severe disease. Okay, what we're doing this week, we only have one known organism, Listeria. How do you pronounce that?
Monocytogenes.
Okay. It's not monocytogenes. Monocytogenes. Okay. So that means everybody's doing it. No groupsy whoopsie today.
Groupsy whoopsie.
No pairs. Everybody does their own Listeria. Okay. Put it on blood, chocolate, and do a gram stain. What should it look like under gram stain? Okay. For the unknown, this is a spinal fluid aspirate. We have already done the lumbar puncture.
That's nice of you.
So take this and streak it to blood with chocolate. We're going to include MTM. Again, this is just for you. Labs don't need to do this, but just for you guys. What does MTM grow? Okay. So it's selective for pathogenic Neisseria. However, what other Neisseria will grow on there that's not pathogenic?
Lactamica.
Okay. And gram stain. So that's what we do today. Then tomorrow, now this is just an abbreviated, very abbreviated flowchart. So any of the gram positives are possible. Staphs, straps, Neisseria, Haemophilus, Listeria.
That lactamica, the Neisseria lactamica, in cerebral spinal fluid, isn't that also a pathogen though? Anything in that?
Anything in a spinal fluid, yes, would be considered a pathogen. Well, I shouldn't say that because you can get staph epidermidis, which could be a contaminant, just from the skin. But Neisseria shouldn't be from the skin. Okay, so if you get any gram-positive cocci, staphs, or streps, follow your other flow diagram. Don't just do this.
How do we determine the most likely pathogens then? All of them. They're all.
Yeah. This week you probably don't have to do that because spinal fluid is a sterile fluid and you shouldn't have anything in there. The only thing that might be in there is the contaminant, staph epidermidis, if the skin is not cleansed properly. That's a possibility. But anything else in there would be considered pathogen, so you don't have to determine what is the most probable. Okay.
How would you determine from staph aureus if it was a contaminant or the actual thing, just based on the patient's symptoms and other things? Or?
Age of the patient, the amount of growth. You get really a lot of growth of the staph aureus. And if you have a gram-positive rod, okay, this is Listeria. We're not doing other gram-positive rods. So what I want you to do is catalase, should be catalase positive, do a motility, not an MIO, but a motility, set one up at 25, one at 37, see what happens. Do a bioesculent. Should be bioesculent positive. And that's all you really have to do for Listeria. Look at the growth patterns. What should it look like on blood?
Beta hemolytic.
Right. Okay, so look at your growth patterns on your media and use your bioesculent.
Is that what you also want us to do on our known Listeria?
Yes. Your known, and if you suspect an unknown, do them both that way. This, if you suspect you have negative Dipple cocci, which could be Neisseria, go back to your other flow diagram and follow that. If you suspect gram-negative coccal bacilli or rods, do Haemophilus. If you suspect Haemophilus, so go back to your other flow diagrams. Okay, so make sure you follow through and do everything that you're supposed to do. Okay, that's it. Let's have fun with Neisseria.
Thank you.